Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 179 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
I'm good, man. How about you?
I'm doing great.
Yeah?
I really had a good week so far.
Good.
I'm super excited because my new NBA 2K21 is coming out on Xbox this week. So, you know, if there's any listeners out there that have older sons or husbands, or maybe even you, whoever plays 2K21,
right?
If you're a good player, I always need people to play with.
Look him up.
Exactly.
He's Fergie 2.0.
I'm not, but no. You can email me. All right, buddy. We got a lot going on this weekend.
We do.
On TCAT, we have an episode out right now. It's part two of the Kevin Coe case, the South Hill rapist.
It's good stuff.
It's good stuff. It's also rough.
It is very rough.
You know, the details in episode one were rough. There are some details in episode two that will make your toenails curl.
I never thought I would say or hear the word dildo so many times.
Yeah, there was a lot of that talk. And unfortunately, it was in the trial a lot.
Sure was.
But so make sure you check that out. We talked about the news of Scott Peterson's death conviction being overturned on our weekly Patreon episode.
We did.
I'll be interested to keep my eye on that one, see what's going on there as it moves along. But right now, I think we need to give our new Patreon shout outs. We had Rebecca Chan.
Hey, Rebecca.
Amy.
Thanks, Amy.
Jessica Abney.
What's up, Abney?
Tiara Baines.
Hey, thanks, Tiara.
Care.
What's up, Care?
Chip Mathis.
Hey, Chip.
William Cordell. Well,
thank you, William.
Savasti Lucas.
Ooh, Savasti.
Tracy Shannon.
Hey, thanks, Tracy.
Bridget Rudzik.
What's up, Rudzik?
Melanie Reller.
Hey, thanks, Melanie.
Carol.
Well, thank you, Carol.
Molly Gubert.
What's happening, Molly?
Joe.
Just Joe?
Yep.
Okay.
Hedge Tunheim.
What's up, Hedge?
Jill.
Hey, Jill.
Sandra.
And Sandra.
Grace.
Well, good grace to you, Grace.
A lot of one-word names right there, sure. All in a row. Paul Malin.
What's happening, Paul?
Kathy Jezdemir.
Jezdemir.
John Kite.
What's going on, John?
Steve Wicklin.
Hey, Wicklin.
Charisse Willis.
Well, thank you, Charisse.
Brandon Arnbrister.
Ooh, they are Arnbrister.
Maria Cupo.
What's going on, Maria?
Claire Lewis.
Thank you, Claire.
And Hunter Rafferty.
What's up, Hunter?
So we appreciate all that new support, Gibbs. And then if we go back into the vault, this week we selected Annie and Theodore Katz.
Oh, well, thank you, Annie and Theodore.
Been with us a long time, and that's very much appreciated.
It really is.
We had some PayPal donations. We had Michelle Robinson.
Hey, thanks, Michelle.
Pauline Timms.
What's going on, Pauline?
Lori McConaughey.
Well, thank you, McConaughey.
And Catherine Wolk.
Well, thank you, Catherine.
So thanks to all of you as well. All right, buddy, are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
Yeah, I really am.
We're talking about the tragic 1974 unsolved murders of the Raker sisters. So we're headed to St. Cloud, Minnesota. Mary and Suzanne Raker went to a local store on Labor Day in 1974, but never returned home. This event had the community searching for them for the next 26 days. Until, tragically, their decomposed bodies were found. But I think before, Gibbs, we get into the details of that, let's talk a little bit about the sisters. We found some information. I was a little surprised about how little there was for a case that was reported on pretty heavily.
Yeah, it was really difficult to find a lot of information.
Mary Catherine Raker was born on May 19th, 1959 in St. Cloud, Minnesota, to Fred and Rita Raker. She was the oldest of six siblings. She had three younger sisters, Elizabeth, Suzanne, and Leah. She had two younger brothers, Martin and Matthew.
It's a big Catholic family right there.
It's very big. I don't know if it's not unusually large.
Well, I thought growing up with two siblings was a lot.
Well, I'm an only child, so I can't really talk too much.
Imagine if you had to share everything you had with five other people.
And split it. Yeah.
Yeah, you would have been happy.
I got you. Yeah. I'm with you now. Throughout her school years, Mary had a love for music and participated in band and choir. At the time of her disappearance and murder, she was 15 years old and a sophomore at a private school named St. Francis High School in Little Falls. She had to take a 40-minute bus ride to and from St. Francis every school day.
Man, that would, I'm just saying, that would really suck.
Yeah, it's not ideal.
No.
They didn't live in Little Falls.
No.
So, you know, they wanted to send her to this private school. A 40-minute ride each way is rough. Now, I will say this. My daughter's school is not even a mile from my house.
Yeah.
It's a 40-minute bus ride. Because of
all the different stops.
Because of all the stops and how it has to go.
Yeah, so. That's a school bus versus getting on. I'm assuming she probably got on a city bus or something that dropped her off. You know, it's just the commute over to that city to drop her off to that school.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how it worked. Either way, right? It's almost 2 hours of your life every school day.
Yeah.
Mary's dream was to become a teacher when she got older. Her younger sister, Suzanne Marie Raker, was born on July 4th, 1962. And at an early age, just like her older sister, Suzanne had a love for music, especially the violin. At the time of her disappearance and murder, she was only 12 years old and a seventh grader at Pope John the 22nd school. She played the violin for her school's orchestra. She wanted to be a professional violinist and a doctor when she was older.
Why not be both? I like that.
Yeah. She had extremely lofty dreams. And I think that's always good for kids.
I think so too. Shoot for the stars, man.
I mean, Gibbs, how many kids say that, you know, from a young age, they want to be the pixie dust spreader on the Tilt-A-Whirl?
Well, only those ones that don't listen to us anymore that we scared off many, many episodes ago.
The carnies?
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, all jokes aside, you want your kids to aspire to be something that, first of all, they want to be.
Right.
Right. But also, you know, something that challenges them and will provide for them a good lifestyle. I mean, that's what parents want for their kids. On September 1st, 1974, the Raker family attended a huge family reunion, and Fred, Rita, and the six children had some fun catching up with all of their relatives.
Which for some people is a great experience.
For others, not so much.
Yeah, they're like, what is the maximum amount of time we have to spend here
before we can slink off and,
exactly,
and go home?
Yeah, and take these same color t-shirts we all have with our name on them off.
I guess it depends on how extended the family reunion is,
yeah,
and what the different branches of your family are like, I guess.
But I know you like them because you won the family talent show 3 years in a row now.
Sure.
So
got a big trophy.
Yeah.
It's all good.
It's all about the singing.
The next day was Labor Day, Monday, September 2nd. The family was exhausted, but they got up early to get chores done, and Fred was a local deacon at the Catholic Church. He had to prepare for the upcoming week. Mary and Suzanne, who had just started school the week before, needed some school supplies. However, Rita wanted them to wait until later in the week to go to the store with their other siblings. But Mary and Suzanne kept pressuring their mother all day long to be allowed to walk up to the local Zayre's discount store to buy a few items. We've all been there. Every parent's been there. I don't care how many times you say no, your child will not let up.
No, I've been on both sides. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I wanted to get to that and get my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I wanted to use it at school. I just wanted to have the stuff to have some cool new stuff.
Were you the one that would flop down on the floor and flail the arms and legs?
I did that all the way up until my senior year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've all been there, right? It's tough to say no to your kids. Well, I shouldn't say that. I say no all the time. It's tough when they won't let it go.
I know.
You know? And eventually, sometimes we as parents give in.
Yeah.
Because, you know, after a while, you just don't want to deal with it anymore.
I always did the opposite. I let them believe they were going to get it, but then we got up right up to the time to pay. I'd rip it out of their hands.
Well, that's just because you didn't want to let go of your money. That's not because you didn't want them to have the stuff.
We can break your old pencils in half and get some more use out of them.
But I think this is exactly what happened to Rita. You know, Mary and Suzanne, they kind of wore her down over the day. Yeah. And at some point, she reluctantly said yes. They could go get some things and then get back because they had some chores that needed to be done before dinner. Mary and Suzanne headed out around 11:30 a.m. They smiled and said goodbye to their mother and father as they headed up the street towards the store. But Gibbs, this was the last time their parents would ever see them alive. And to me, it's hard to imagine that moment frozen in your mind, your daughter smiling, saying goodbye as they bounced out of the house. You know, they were happy because they were getting to do what they wanted to do, but that's an image that is going to be with you forever. It's a good image.
It is.
Unless it's the last one you have of them. And that's the problem here.
And that's the image that's going to continue to replay again and again.
The store was about a mile up the street from their house. So it was around a, 18-minute walk probably?
Yeah, about there.
The girls were spotted at the Zayre's discount store at the Shopper City Plaza before noon. Another witness told police they saw Mary inside the local Shopco department store near the Zayre store around noon. And then the girls were last seen at Zayre's around 1:30 p.m. When Mary and Suzanne didn't return home in time for dinner, their parents were concerned, as I think most parents would be, Gibbs. They called several friends and family in the area and asked them if the girls had stopped by on their way home. No one they talked to had seen them that day. They then called some of Mary's school friends in Little Falls just in case the girls decided to visit friends, but they hadn't.
Well, this is when the Rakers had to call the St. Cloud police and report the girls missing.
Yeah, because I think by that point, right, when you've talked to friends, you talk to family, and you're not hearing anything good, the girls haven't returned home, the panic meter is rising, and probably very rapidly.
I know each of us would be very concerned.
Yes.
Because we know our kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, we can get into the conversation of, you know, do I let my kids go to the store alone at that age? Now, me personally, when my kids were that age, no. But it also wasn't 1974.
Well, exactly.
And I think you do have to take that into account.
Yeah, in that time frame, I mean, I know, because I was a kid during that time, I was riding my bike everywhere.
Yes.
And, I mean, I'd get up in the morning and leave with my buddies and not come back until sometimes, the end of the day or early evening.
Yeah, I think you and I have discussed it a couple of times before, but there's no doubt that I know you and I had much more freedom when we were kids than our kids had at that same age. The police interviewed the family that night and they questioned the other children. They wanted to know if Mary or Suzanne were unhappy living at home to the point that they could have possibly wanted to escape and run away. The siblings that were old enough to talk to the police said no, they would not run away. They were really happy living at home. But here's where we get into what I think we find in a lot of these unsolved cases back from the 70s.
Right.
And it's the police looking at, you know, a couple of kids or one kid who's missing and kind of automatically jumping to the runaway theory.
Yes.
I think that happened quite a bit back then. Because the police told the family there really wasn't anything they could do that night, but the next day they would check out the shopping center, they would look for the girls, but they also told the family that, okay, the girls most likely ran off with some friends to have some fun, or they decided to run away. And I think it's important to note that the authorities had seen a pretty massive increase in runaways in the preceding years.
Right.
Now, were those true runaways or were those cases of kids that disappeared and they just assumed they were runaways? That I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I don't know if they could really say if they know the answer to that.
No, because when things are unsolved, the answers are not there.
Exactly.
So you can look at it a couple of different ways. On Tuesday, September 3rd, Fred and Rita thought they found the girls when police told them that they had a report that morning that Mary and Suzanne just purchased bus tickets to Little Falls for the bus that had just recently left the station. Okay. Wow. You've got a ton of hope. You're on cloud nine. Oh. You think you're about ready to find your two daughters.
I'd be ecstatic and I would be jumping in my vehicle.
The ticket salesman told police when asked about the two girls that one of them had purchased a ticket and said that she looked like the oldest girl, Mary. Fred and Rita, along with the St. Cloud police, made the drive over to Little Falls, and they got there before the bus arrived. But as the passengers came off that bus, they saw a girl who resembled Mary, but it wasn't her. They asked this girl if there were any other children on the bus, and she said no, just her. So, I mean, I think in the span of probably, what, 40 minutes or so?
Yeah.
40 minutes to an hour, you as a parent go from cloud nine back down to maybe even a lower level of despair because your hopes are dashed.
Yeah, what an emotional roller coaster that was.
I think at that point, the parents were even more distraught than before because their girls weren't on this bus. And we talked about it, right? The police, it seemed as though we're telling the family, you know, there's not a lot we can do. We kind of think there's a possibility that your daughters ran away.
Right.
Now, at the same time, the parents are pressuring them. They're keeping up the pressure. They're asking the police to, you know, perform searches. Police had no evidence of foul play. They had no witnesses to lead them in really any one direction. So I think that plays a big part, Gibbs, right? I don't like the jumping to the runaway angle.
Right.
Not crazy about that. I get it. Maybe there were a lot of kids that were runaways at that point in time. They don't have any evidence of foul play. They don't have any witnesses to say we saw somebody take the girls. But you also don't have any friends that say, yeah, they talked to me about running away. They were having a tough time. So I don't know. You can look at it a couple different ways.
The problem I have with this is we know that the first 48 hours is critical.
Sure.
So wouldn't it be best for everybody to initially investigate it as worst case?
Yes.
And then backtrack if you have to. At least if there's any opportunity to pick up a lead that could take you to the girls and you could find them or get ahead of whatever you need to get ahead of. But when you do it this way, you're wasting all that critical time.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think if I made a call today to police, that's the way they would handle it. But in the 70s, and I don't know when, you know, that kind of turned, it seems like in the 70s for sure, it wasn't exactly that way. We've talked about a number of cases, even with kids, where they said, well, we can't start the investigation until X.
Right.
We know they don't do that today.
No.
When a kid is reported missing, that search kind of starts immediately. You've got the Amber Alerts. You've got all these things that go out. But like with anything, you know, we learn from mistakes or from doing things a certain way. Eventually you figure out it's not the best way to do it. So changes are made. One thing that I was really kind of blown away by, Gibbs, was that the family, the parents, they wanted to organize their own search, but were told by police that they could not hold big, extensive searches. They couldn't hold rallies because it would be disruptive to the community.
Now, I'd have a big problem with that.
It kind of goes against almost every case that we cover, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times it's the victim's family that helps organize the searches in conjunction with the police. But for police to tell the family, no, don't get a bunch of people to help you search. Don't hold a rally or a vigil or, you know, anything like that. Don't galvanize the community. That will be disruptive. Wow. That's rough.
I just have a huge problem. Okay, you don't believe me? I'm telling you my kids are missing. They did not run away. I'm going to have a rally. I'm going to do whatever I want to do to get the troops behind me. If you, the police, don't want to participate, that's on you. I'm going to do what I want to do. I don't know how you have the right to tell me I cannot do that.
Well, you know, if you want to fine me or ticket me for disruption or whatever, right, go ahead. But I'm looking for my daughters. Exactly. You know, I think you and I both would be taking that tact, as would a lot of parents. Fred hired a well-known psychologist to analyze his entire family. Basically, he wanted to prove to police and to the public that his daughters had no reason to run away. They were missing. They had been taken. Something had happened, but they had not run away. The psychologist confirmed that the two girls had a good family life and were not likely candidates to have run away.
Who would have thought that you'd have to go to that extent to rally the authorities behind you?
Mm-hmm. And the public, because I think that was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, in the reporting, it definitely talked about trying to win over the public, and that's much different than most unsolved or disappearance cases that we do. Usually the public comes out and says, what can we do?
Yeah.
Let me help you.
But in the 70s, a lot of people took their lead from the authorities. So if the authorities didn't think it was a missing person,
you're probably right on.
They're going to back up the police and say, it's just a runaway.
Yeah, you're probably right on. So I think what you had, when you boil it down, you have Fred and Rita distraught about their daughters. They didn't like the fact that police weren't investigating, searching the way that they thought they should be. But at the same time, they didn't want to attack the police because they needed them. And they were hoping that police were going to see very quickly that, okay, no, these girls didn't run away. We've got to launch a massive investigation. So I thought that was interesting, that the dynamic between the family and the police, they don't agree with the police.
Right.
But at the same time, they don't want to tick them off because they don't want to create animosity that then later is going to backfire.
Yeah. I see some interviews that Rita did where she had to, you could tell she literally had to bite her tongue with some of the conversations she had with the police back then.
Yeah, because she probably wanted to excoriate the police, but she realized that it wouldn't be in her best interest.
Right.
And they really shouldn't have had to walk that tightrope, but they did. And I think what they hoped would happen is exactly what did, right? Because 2 weeks after the girls went missing, the St. Cloud police decided that the girls really were missing and treated them as such. Now, you can say 2 weeks is ridiculous.
Right.
It really is.
Oh.
You talked about 48 hours.
Yeah.
We're talking about 2 weeks now.
Yeah. Too much time to pass.
Yes, it really is. On September 16th, the police prepared a flyer with information on both girls. It also included their photos. The police sent the flyers to all the surrounding cities, as well as the major cities in Minnesota and some major cities around the U.S. They were hoping to get some information, any information about the sisters' whereabouts. Now, eventually, a $10,000 reward was offered for information that led to finding the missing girls. The flyer stated that Mary was 5'3" and weighed 115 pounds. She had brown hair, green eyes, and wore glasses. She was last seen wearing blue jeans and an army jacket. Suzanne was 4'11" and weighed 100 pounds. She had long, dark brown hair to her waist, brown eyes, and also wore glasses. She was last seen wearing a white cotton short jacket and blue corduroy jeans. It was also reported that the girls didn't have much cash on them. And I think this is interesting as it relates to the runaway aspect.
Yeah.
Right. They're going to the store to buy some school supplies. They don't have hundreds of dollars on them. So how are they planning to parlay this small amount of money into running away?
Yeah. Where are they going to stay? How are they going to travel?
at such a young age.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to have some way of making some money. If you don't have it with you at that age, what are you going to do? There's nothing that you can do to make that type of money.
And most kids that age don't have that kind of money.
No.
To finance a runaway. After the flyer went out, an intense search for the missing girls was started by police, the FBI, and the local community. But no leads came in regarding the disappearance of the Raker sisters. I'll go back to it. You know, is it because it didn't start for 2 weeks? You can't tell me that it didn't hurt the investigation waiting that long.
I agree with you. Yeah, it's a shame.
Then on Saturday, September 28th, around 2 p.m., two teenage boys were walking through one of the local abandoned stone quarries when they stumbled across what would later be identified as 12-year-old Suzanne Raker. Her partially decomposed body was lying in some thick brush about 50 feet from the edge of the quarry pond. The boys ran off to call the St. Cloud police, who arrived on the scene along with the Stearns County Sheriff. Once on the scene, the county sheriff took over as chief investigator because Suzanne's body was found in the county and not in the city limits. It was found about 3.5 miles from the city in a place known as the Waite Park Quarry. The sheriff's department and the St. Cloud police searched the area for Mary right away.
Well, they felt pretty strongly that Mary had to be nearby.
Yeah, I think the thought all along, even when police thought that the girls had run away, the thought would have been that they were together. So, you know, finding Suzanne's body, the natural assumption would be, well, it's not going to be good, but Mary most likely has to be pretty close by.
Right.
They found some of Mary's clothes hanging on some rocks overlooking the pond. It was basically as if they were tossed over the edge into the quarry from up high.
Yeah.
Authorities called for a search and rescue dive team who searched the waters, and they found Mary's nude body at the bottom of the pond. It took them 4 hours.
It's a long time.
Well, it's not in real time, but it's a long time for parents, for people that are hoping against hope that their daughter's body's not in that pond.
Yeah.
That's a long 4 hours. It's excruciating.
I remember when I was younger, I thought about doing my cold water dives and things like that, your night dives and getting certified so you could kind of do that kind of stuff.
Mm, yeah.
And then I talked to some people that did do that, and it didn't seem that appealing. They said it was pretty freaky down there in these lakes and deep quarry ponds, things like that at nighttime, trying to figure out which way's up and down. And if you're going to try to search for a body, it's not going to be easy.
Well, you're not talking about Castaway with Tom Hanks, where you have this clear vision. I mean, around here, if you've got a pond or a quarry or whatever, it's murky as hell.
Right.
You can't see, in most cases, a foot or two, you know,
at best.
Yeah, it's a little scary, especially if the thought is you're looking for a body.
Yeah.
And you're kind of stumbling around even with a flashlight. That wouldn't be for me. I'm claustrophobic anyway, so scuba diving, stuff like that is out.
Right.
No. Yeah. Mm-mm. I like to be able to breathe on my own. I don't want to have a machine that I'm dependent on to take a breath. Yeah. That is kind of a claustrophobic's worst nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Outside of being like nailed shut in a box, you know, or shut up in a closet that you can't get out of. But
now you just told that potential serial killer out there, like that guy from Saw, what they need to do to you if they ever catch you.
Yeah, I am pretty claustrophobic in certain situations, no doubt about it. You know, but back to what you were saying, Gibbs, I mean, I think that's like that with a good number of jobs. There are many things like that where it takes a certain kind of person to be able to do that job, right? Firemen.
Yeah.
All right. Not everybody is going to be willing to run into a burning building. That takes a certain kind of person. Police officer, heart surgeon. Not everybody's got the nerves, you know, to go that route. Even if they do all the schooling, right, it still takes a certain kind of person to literally hold a person's life in your hands. And I could name a whole bunch of other jobs too, but so they found Mary's body and the police looked at it as though the killer had tossed her body off the edge to the water. It was about 40 feet below. So, you know, it's a pretty good drop off, right? Yeah. These quarries down to the water. The bodies of both Suzanne and Mary Raker were taken to the medical examiner in Hennepin County because Stearns County wasn't really accustomed to handling murder victims, especially murder victims of such a young age.
You know what? If you don't know what you're doing or how to do it right, send it to somebody that knows how to do it. And that's what they did.
Yeah. My understanding is Hennepin County is a big county. So obviously their staff would have much more experience because they would be doing it much more often. Investigators have kept the details pretty tight over the years about the deaths of the two sisters, but the medical examiner released information that Mary had been stabbed to death in her chest 6 times and that Suzanne had been stabbed in her upper torso 13 times.
12 years old, stabbed her in her chest 13 times. That's pretty aggressive. Not pretty aggressive. That's outright aggressive.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Investigators said that the killer had used a knife to cut Mary's shirt away and then also cut her bra before stabbing her to death. The other thing that investigators have stated publicly is that Mary's watch stopped working at 3:25 p.m. on Labor Day, and they used this to help estimate her time of death. On that same Saturday, the sheriff told the press that he had set up a hotline to receive any information about the case. He wanted anyone in the public who had seen the girls at Zaire's or Shopko on Labor Day between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. to call the hotline with any information. He also told the press that the Stearns County Sheriff's Department, along with an investigator from St. Cloud and one from the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, had formed a task force to find the killer or killers responsible for these murders. He also made mention that they would utilize help from the FBI. And I say this quite a bit, but I think it's important. I don't like the fact that they waited as long as they did.
Right.
But I like the fact that they weren't afraid to include other agencies, including the FBI, because I think that's important.
Yeah, I think there's some cases that certain agencies don't want to work together, right? And I think this is important. You know, you have to work together and utilize the resources that each agency brings to the table.
Yeah, I think the worst thing that can happen is if you have a local, smaller agency that says, we want to solve this on our own.
Right.
And we don't want help from the FBI, and we don't want help from, you know, whatever Bureau of Investigations is in your state. Why the hell not?
Yeah.
You don't have the technology that all these other people do. Don't turn that down just because you don't want to be seen as weak, or is in some cases you want to be the one to have the glory in solving the case. It's not about that. No. It's about figuring out what happened to these girls and providing answers to their family and holding somebody accountable for their actions.
It always reminds me of that scene in The Fugitive with Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones, you know, where he's drawing the circle on the map and they're fighting over who's going to lead.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and finally Tommy Lee Jones is, you know, he bulldozes them over and he's taking the lead and telling them what they have to do.
That's a great movie.
It really is a good movie.
I like Tommy Lee Jones and I like Harrison Ford.
They're a good combo.
Tommy Lee Jones has been in a lot of good movies too.
Yeah.
Kind of underrated, I think. He was great in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, he really was.
I really thought he was good in that movie. Yeah. Fred Raker made a statement that Saturday to the press saying, we are frustrated to think that two gentle girls who never could have hurt anyone would have been so hurt themselves. The one thing I do want to say is that we knew immediately on Monday evening when they did not come home that they were in trouble. Whenever they went downtown shopping or visiting friends or whatever, we always knew where they were going, who they would be with, and when they would return. We didn't question them about it. They told us voluntarily. If they were going to be late or needed a ride, they would call us. They would never have hitchhiked. We always trusted our girls because they never gave us any reason not to trust them. We knew they had not run away. So that's a sad father making a statement to the press, but it's also a frustrated father. And you can hear that coming out by him saying, we knew this on Monday. Yeah, we told the police this on Monday.
We know our kids.
Yeah.
We know our kids.
Fred further told the press that he felt his girls' murders were a result of a killer who had glorified violence that they saw on TV. He felt television and movie producers were getting too graphic on the TV and the big screen, which he thought was producing more violence in real life. He said he hoped that they would stop after knowing this is what most likely caused the murders of their daughters. I think that's a tough statement to make. I think the argument and the discussion between violence on TV, violence in the movies, violence in music, mm-hmm. violence in video games.
Yeah.
It's been going on for quite a number of years now. I don't know if there's data out there that shows that that causes people to be more violent, but I think it's tough to make the statement that's saying that whoever killed his daughters did so because of TV and the movies. I just think that's really tough to say that.
Well, especially back in 74, I think it's really tough. You know, when you're
because it wasn't, it's a drop in the bucket from what we see today.
Yeah, it was very heavily censored TV.
Yes.
You know, the movies was a different thing. I mean, they still were rated. But like you said today, though, between the video games, the music, and, the 1,000 channel cable TV shows you have out there, who knows?
Yeah, we're inundated with much more violence today. So I think it's a tough statement to make in 74. Yeah. Now, he's a grieving father. He can say whatever he
Absolutely,
wants.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure how he was making that correlation that for sure –
Right.
Whoever killed his daughters did so because of TV and movies. There's just no way to definitively make that correlation.
Right.
Just days after the girls' bodies were discovered, the family was able to put them to rest. Services were held on October 2nd, 1974 at St. John's Cantius Church. Over 1,000 people attended the service.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot. It's a lot. But you also have two very young girls murdered. That brings a lot of people out.
Sure.
There's a lot of sympathy. I also think there's a lot of, that could have been my child. And I want to pay my respects. During the investigation, the authorities pretty quickly found out that Mary and Suzanne were well-liked, didn't have any enemies. They loved school. They loved their family. These were two happy kids. Authorities also knew that the family had a good reputation in the area, and they couldn't find anyone with a grudge against them that would want to hurt the family. Investigators theorized that the killer or killers were local, and they knew the area well enough to know about the abandoned quarries. This is something that the Raker family believed as well. They came out and said that they thought the killer was a boy or a man who did this with or without an accomplice.
I kind of agree with the fact that it was probably somebody local.
Well, it was also probably a boy or a man with or without an accomplice. Right. You just cast pretty much the entire male net.
Population.
Yeah, population. But another thing that you and I touch on quite a bit because it comes up, right? Was this a killer that was just traveling through town, saw these girls, abducted them,
yeah.
and somehow found this quarry. Or, as the authorities believed, the killer was local and knew exactly where this quarry was and knew that this was the place to take these girls. You know, I can see why they would think that, because if you're not from around the area, are you just stumbling upon it?
Yeah, I think
you, probably not.
No, I don't think so either. I think you know it because you live there. You know, just like, I mean, I grew up in an area where we would go to the quarries, sneak in and swim.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we did. You know,
nighttime. Naked as a jaybird, probably.
Well, that's what we all did, you know, and you had your fun and you got out before you got in trouble and life went on, you know. But I think that's happened all across the country, the world, you know, when there's empty quarries, people go there because they know that you're going to have those freshwater ponds you can swim in.
Or fish. Sometimes there's really good fishing.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, what does local mean? Because I think that is a good question. Doesn't mean that they lived right down the street from the Rakers.
Right.
They could have been a town over, two towns over, and still maybe have known about the quarry.
Yeah.
So local is kind of a relative term. I just think, to me, it means more likely than not, it's not a person jumping off the train,
right?
You know, like a Tommy Lynn Sells.
First time passerby.
Yeah, blowing through town for the first time ever and finding this quarry. One thing that did turn up during the investigation was an entry in Mary's diary that was made just days before her death. Her parents found this when they were scouring the house looking for clues. Mary wrote, "If I am murdered, find my killer and see that justice is done. I have a few reasons to fear for my life, and what I ask is important."
That's huge.
I think it's absolutely huge. It's just not something that you think a girl of that age would write in their diary.
Right.
Most 15-year-olds don't have anything like that in their diary, is what I would assume.
Which shouldn't be a concern that they should ever have, right? They shouldn't be worried about something like that.
No, I get that there's general concern about being hurt, being molested. I understand that. This is very specific.
Right.
I have a few reasons to be concerned about my life.
Yeah.
And it certainly sparked the investigator's interest, right? They would have thought the same thing. Why would a 15-year-old girl write something like this, but never mention it to a single family member or to a single friend?
Yeah, why hold that in? Why keep that to yourself? Why not go to your mom, your dad, anybody and say, "Hey, I'm worried I might get murdered."
If you're that fearful of losing your life. So what investigators needed to figure out was, what and who was Mary afraid of at the time she wrote that diary entry? They interviewed a young man named Jacob Younger, who recalled seeing Mary and Suzanne at Zayer's on Labor Day. And he said he heard Suzanne tell Mary, "I don't want to go with that man. I don't like him. Let's not." Jacob said this was somewhere around 1 p.m. Then he later said he saw a large man walking around nervously outside the store right before the girls left it.
So did Suzanne say that to Mary because Mary wanted to go with this man? Or did she say it to Mary just as, "Hey, let's not go with that man because that man asked both of them, hey, I need you guys to come with me"?
It's a little unclear, and I think you can make a couple of different things out of it.
Right.
The one thing I will say just personally is that if one of the girls knew the man, I would think it would be more likely that it was Mary.
Right.
She's 3 years older.
Yeah.
She's still not very old. I mean, she's only 15 years old, right. But.
And what is a man to Suzanne? You know, could it be somebody just 16, 17, 18, or is she considering, when she's saying a man, you know, somebody that's
30, male. You mean male.
Male.
Yeah. Over the years, there have been some persons of interest in the murders of the Raker sisters. Reverend Richard Eckroth, who back in 1974 was a monk at St. John's Abbey in Collegeville, was considered a person of interest. Mary and Suzanne were with a group of church youths that Reverend Eckroth took to his lakeshore cabin in Beltrami County 2 years before their deaths. The girls had spent the night there on two occasions. Years later, the Reverend was accused by several men and teenagers of nearly 400 counts of sexual molestation.
That's a large number.
400.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how many counts are associated with each victim. Probably a lot.
Yeah.
You know, we just on TCAT finished up the story on Kevin Coe. His victims are thought to number in the high 50s. 400 counts is a lot.
That's quite a bit.
Eckroth insisted he had nothing to do with the murders of Mary and Suzanne. Plus, all of his known victims were male. So I think, you know, that puts a lot of people off of him,
right,
as the likely killer. He molested young boys and young males. So would he have gone after these two young girls? What would have been his motivation? In the early 1990s, he offered to take a polygraph test. He did. He passed. And that satisfied Fred and Rita Raker that he was not the killer of their daughters.
I think with what you said about his victims being all male, the fact that he passed this, I can see how that would lead them to that conclusion.
Michael J. Bartoszewski, a man who lived six blocks from the Raker family in 1974, was sentenced to life in prison for the 1978 stabbing death of 8-year-old Michelle Talbot in Colorado. Michael was a tall, awkward, but well-built guy. And a lot of people have asked the question, could he have been the guy waiting outside the store that Jacob Younger saw after talking to Mary?
That's a good point. You know, maybe he was.
But there's a lot of guys that are large, yeah. You know, a large man. I mean, when you're talking to a younger person,
yeah.
Well, what's a large man right. to them? Anybody bigger than them?
Exactly.
So yeah. You have to take that into account.
And maybe this large man that was outside the store had nothing to do with it right. anyway. Maybe he was just waiting for his kids or wife or whoever to get done shopping. And he was just wandering around outside because he didn't want to be in the store.
Yeah, it's easy to make the correlation between the large man and the fact that Mary said, I don't want to go with that man.
Right.
Well, doesn't mean it was that man.
Exactly.
But people do make that correlation. Another person of interest is serial killer Harvey Kerrigan, who I'm sure Gibbs will cover in a future episode of TCAT. He committed murders in several states and in the 1960s received the death penalty in Alaska, but had it overturned and actually got released.
How about that, man?
After getting the death penalty, he was a pretty sick guy, a sick killer who in 1973 and 1974 terrorized the state of Minnesota. He picked up hitchhikers. He abducted young females off the street, sexually assaulted them, and then killed them. On September 8th, 1974, he persuaded two girls, June Lynch and Lisa King, both 16 years old, into his car in Minneapolis and raped and bludgeoned them to death. And then just the following week, he abducted Gwen Burton from a parking lot and left her for dead. But miraculously, Gwen survived. But of course, Gibbs, she had to live with the traumatic effects of what happened to her. Harvey then assaulted two young girls on September 18th, 1974, who were able to escape and survive. 2 days later, he abducted and killed Kathy Schultz. Harvey's murder weapon of choice was a hammer.
Yeah, he liked to beat their heads in is what he liked to do.
Yeah, he was a bludgeoner.
Yeah. And he liked to use the handle part to sexually assault them with.
Well, yeah, he said he was a really sick guy. And there's no doubt he was. But because his weapon of choice was a hammer and not a knife, that's the reason most people believe that he's probably not the killer of the Raker sisters, since they were stabbed to death.
And no doubt about it, he was in the area at the time of their murders.
And he's a really horrible serial killer. So you can see why people would at least link him as a possibility.
The See, this is just like every case we cover.
It's too many bad people, man.
That's it, man. You dive into something like this, and you just find one after the other, and there's some that didn't even make the radar that you know are out there as well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And sometimes the next is worse than the previous guy, and it just gets to the point sometimes in the research where you're like, how can this many really horrible people be living, operating, killing, doing all these bad things at the same time around the same area? It's a scary thought.
Why can't they cross each other's paths and just take each other
out? Take each other out?
Yeah.
He was later arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison. The final person of interest and the one that I think most people believe likely killed the Raker sisters, including their parents, was a man named Herb Notch. Herb was working at Zayer's the day the girls went missing. He knew Mary's previous boyfriend. Herb also lived in the neighboring town where the sisters' grandparents lived. So in the years leading up to their deaths, the sisters and their siblings had spent a lot of weekends with their grandparents.
Yeah.
So there's a connection there because he lived close by.
And Mary being 15, and at that time he was 16 when he was working at Zayer, so he's pretty close in age.
But here's why I think he's a major person of interest. On September 25th, 1976, by that time he was 18 years old, Herb and his 17-year-old friend James Wagner walked into a convenience store in St. Cloud called the Dairy Bar. Herb told his friend that he wanted to pretend to rob it. I don't know who walks into a store and pretends to rob it. Yeah,
that's not going to work out well if you're going to pretend to rob something.
You're still
going to
get in trouble.
Exactly.
Pretending to rob it. When they walked inside, 14-year-old Sue Dukowitz was at the register while her dad, the owner, was next door. These two boys pointed a gun and a knife at her, and they ordered her to hand over money from the cash register and then forced her to go with them to the car. They drove her to an abandoned gravel pit. Herb Notch tied her hands, and then he cut her shirt open with his knife and then cut her bra and underwear. He sexually assaulted Sue, then stabbed her several times and left her for dead. So obviously, the tie-in here, Gibbs, is that Mary's clothes were cut off her in a very similar way.
Yeah, and stabbed as well.
That's true. Now, Sue Dukowitz survived. She crawled, she eventually walked, and was able to get help. Both young men were arrested and charged with attempted murder, rape, robbery, and kidnapping. Herb received a lesser charge and was sentenced to 40 years. But was paroled after 10.
Man, that was a really, really short period of time.
Yeah, that's 25% of your sentence. His accomplice served 7 years in prison for his role in the crime and has stayed out of trouble ever since. But the same can't be said for Herb Knott. I think you also have to look, Gibbs, at the fact that he gets 10 for his role and the other guy gets 7. Or he gets 40, but he only does 10.
Right.
The other guy does 7. Who I don't know exactly what he did, but it doesn't sound like he participated to the extent that Herb Notch did. It just doesn't seem fair.
Right.
The sentences don't.
Definitely doesn't line up.
But Herb was arrested again in 1988 after a former girlfriend accused him of kidnapping and raping her. He was found guilty of false imprisonment and burglary. Then in 1992, he was arrested for the sexual assault of a female after he tied her up. She reported the crime to police, but Herb had fled to Phoenix, Arizona, where he used his brother's ID. His brother was already in prison for murder after he killed his sleeping roommate with 2 bullets to the head.
So,
a family you don't want to cross?
Yeah, exactly.
There's always that one family in town that you know you do not want to get on their bad side.
What's that movie with the family with all the redheaded kids?
Billy Madison?
Remember they would chant.
O'Doul? Or, no, was it? Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And they end up
Going off the cliff?
Yeah, going off the cliff. I think that's Billy Madison. But there's a family like that in every town.
Right.
Sometimes multiples. Herb Notch was eventually apprehended after 14 months on the run, but he was acquitted of the rape charges. He then married, he settled down back in his hometown. He still had issues with law enforcement over the years. The Raker family believes that Herb Notch killed Suzanne and Mary, but Gibbs, he's never admitted to it.
No.
And he's never been charged with their murders. In May of 2017, while Herb Notch was on his deathbed, Rita, who was 80 years old and a widow, went to his hospital room to speak to him. She pleaded with him to tell her that he killed her daughters. He just told her, "I give you my word, I didn't do it." She later told papers that he was angry, not remorseful, and told her that he already knew he was going to hell.
Yeah. Now, she kind of took when he said that, it was his way of saying, "I did it.
But I don't want to tell you I did it.
Right.
But I don't want to admit to it.
But I'm going to go to, you know, hell anyway. So that's my punishment."
Yeah. Going to hell. I got the feeling that she left that hospital room thinking that it was Herb Notch.
Yeah.
Who had killed her daughters, even though he would not come out and admit it. Now, we mentioned early on that there was a $10,000 reward offered up
right
back in the 70s. Eventually, that was up to $50,000.
Yeah.
Trying to get information on the killers. But eventually, Rita ended up using that money to help others. She helped co-found Tri-County Crime Stoppers, which has assisted with a number of missing persons cases.
Yeah, she's pretty proud of the fact that their rapid response to somebody missing and getting the searches going and getting the flyers out and, you know, helping the families cope with all that activity.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a great thing. She probably thought, you know, we've had this money offered up for so many years.
Yeah.
Nobody's come forward. It's earmarked. It's, you know, it's, we have to hold it back. Let's not do that. Let's use it for something good to honor Mary and Suzanne.
Yeah.
That's my thinking without knowing exactly why she did it. But
sure.
I think it's a pretty good, safe assumption to make. Over the years, investigators have tested DNA found on the girls' clothes, but to date, they've not found a match. They haven't given up, but I do get the sense, Gibbs, that investigators feel that the individual who committed these murders, or individuals, may no longer be alive. And I think that always exists in these cases that go back, you know, 50, 60 years. I mean, even if a person was very young when they committed the crime, there is a chance that they would be deceased by this point. And for me, Gibbs, that's the hard part with these older cases. You know, even if investigators someday are able to get some type of familial DNA match or something along those lines, the chances are high that, you know, the person responsible may be deceased. In those instances, I feel as though even when the authorities are certain they know who did it, you can't hold the person that was responsible accountable. You can't punish a dead person. And then you think about the fact that that person got to live their life free while Suzanne and Mary barely even started theirs. You know, their lives were taken away from them at a very young age. They were so young, and their families never got to hear a jury say that someone was responsible for their murders. I think for me, it's one of the saddest parts of these unsolved cases that we do. First and foremost, you have the victims who lost their lives. That's extremely sad. But then, you know, what these families go through, it's rough.
Yeah.
It's rough.
It really is.
But that's it for the unsolved murders of Mary and Suzanne Raker on Labor Day of 1974. Gibbs, we've got some voicemails. You want to hear those?
Let's check them out.
Hey, Mike. Hey, Gibby. My name is Selena. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I just had to give you all this call because I got to hear my shout out on Unsolved, and I swear I lost my mind. I just got my mom to start listening to you guys. She's in there listening to it right now, and I absolutely just love your podcast. Stay safe and keep your own time ticking. Bye, you guys.
Louisville or Louisville or Louisville.
Or neither one. You heard her say Louisville.
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 Just because you try to say it like Elvis doesn't make it more correct.
It doesn't? Okay.
No. And you even curled your lip down.
I tried to.
Like Elvis. No, but we appreciate that. That's awesome. You know, it's why we do the shout outs. And I know, you know, sometimes they take up a little bit of time, but it's important for us to recognize the people that are helping us to put out this podcast.
So is she a Wildcat or is she a?
I'm assuming she's a Cardinal fan.
Yeah, okay.
But you never know. There are people that live in Louisville
that
root for the Wildcats. But
hi, Mike and Gibby. My name's Emily. I started listening to the podcast about a month or two ago towards the end of quarantine. And I finally got my best friend into it, Allison. And we've been having such a fun time listening to you guys. I mean, it's hard to have fun listening to lots of bad stuff go on. But I mean, it's very entertaining, and we'll sit around and have some art night, and we will, we'll listen to the podcast, and it's been a really good time, so I'm a really big fan, and hopefully you guys are doing well. Bye!
Well, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, it really is, and you hear that from a lot of people. They get their best friend into it, they get a family member into it. And that's awesome where you can share it and talk about it afterwards and go back and forth and debate things.
Maybe they can try to paint you sitting in your podcast chair while you're podcasting, while they drink and, you know, listen to us.
They can do whatever they want while they drink.
I was just trying to get them to paint a picture of you so they can send it, post it, and then we're like, here, this is...
Why not a picture of you? I really don't want a picture of myself. If it included the both of us, okay. I'm not asking you to paint it.
Hey, Mike and Mike. This is Carl Staub, phoning from Cape Town, South Africa. Love your show. I've been binging to it ever since discovering it about 2 weeks ago. Well, in controlled doses just to keep my sanity. But it's been a real, real help kind of while working from home during our quarantine. The show really helps keep the quiet hours entertaining. So sending some love all the way from South Africa. Love it, guys. Keep your own time ticking. This is Carl. Adios.
You know what they have down in Cape Town?
Mm-mm.
Some really big sharks, man.
Do they?
Those big, great white sharks, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
I believe you sometimes. I'll go with it. What I will say is that's a kick-ass accent.
It is.
That is a cool accent.
Yeah. What everybody doesn't know was that me. That was me calling in earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That was my new accent.
Which is why you know so much about Cape Town and South Africa.
Carl, Cape Town, great white sharks.
Elvis.
Hey, fellas. My name is Mindy. I am a big fan of yours. I actually just started listening to you guys a couple weeks ago, and I'm almost caught up. That's how good and awesome you guys are. And also, I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm actually going to Dayton this weekend. So that's pretty cool. When I found out you guys are from Dayton, I was like, yes. So I just want to say thank you for your hard work. Thank you for bringing the stories of the victims to the rest of the world. It is important to remember them. And actually, I think people like you and other podcasts, the more that we talk about sort of thing, I feel like it's a lot easier to see signs in other people, although it is rare. I personally have never met a serial killer or a murderer or anything like that, but I think it would be maybe easier to see something in somebody, or just, you know, just a question, or just to be on the lookout and be, you know, more safe. I'm very aware, so I think it's good to be aware. But anyway, thanks, guys. You're doing a great job. Bye-bye.
I left that voicemail, too. That other voice. No.
That one's really good.
Yeah.
So she says she's never met a serial killer, but how does she know?
You don't know.
You don't know if you don't know that they're a serial killer.
She says she's coming with Dayton. Swing by, have a beer.
And you'll meet one.
Yeah.
No. What I will say is I agree that, you know, it's important to obviously be prepared all the time. Sure. You don't have to be, what's the word, Gibbs? Paranoid to the point where it affects you, but yeah, but you need to keep your head on a swivel. There's no doubt about that.
But keep living your life.
Yeah, you got to live your life and not let fear stop you from doing what you want to do. But I also don't think you can skip down the road singing zippity doo dah and not have an understanding of what's going on around you.
Never really sing that anyway.
No, you probably shouldn't
down the road. But
or whistle it. I think I was going to say whistle it.
Yeah, but I think you trust your instincts. You know, your gut tells you a lot if you listen to it. Mine's telling me you need to eat.
It's time to eat.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So from Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
That's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.